From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, we launch our partnership with the trade magazine Variety with a look at fall movies and which studios have the most at stake. Then Shawn Clifford is up for Best Supporting Actress for Fleabag. She discusses her off-screen friendship with series creator and star Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
We suddenly looked at each other one day and we were like, you know, we never ever discussed how to play those characters. We just knew. And that's why, one of the reasons why she fought for me to play that role.
And we meet Fleabag's composer, Isabel Waller-Bridge. That last name sounds familiar. All that coming up on The Frame. Today, we launch a partnership with Variety that will feature twice weekly segments with the industry magazine's reporters and editors. We start off with senior film writer Matt Donnelly and a look at fall films. With award season approaching, many of the year's most anticipated titles will arrive in theaters over the next few months, and quite a few of those films will first debut at the big festivals in Venice, Telluride, and Toronto, all in just a couple of weeks. Here's Matt Donnelly on how a good festival showing can boost a film's prospects.
I think absolutely critical response is vital for two reasons. Number one, to sort of set the stage for how they might survive their award season, but also for box office. You're talking about a time for indie film that's incredibly tenuous, especially theatrically. So I think, yes, good reviews will either sort of make or break its theatrical life and its earning potential and how much steam it might have through awards.
When I look at some of the big titles that are coming out in the fall, they're clearly big actors' movies like Ford versus Ferrari with Christian Bale and Matt Damon, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, a movie about Mr. Rogers starring Tom Hanks. But there are also some films that are about issues and ideas. Fair and Balanced, a movie about Roger Ailes, and Harriet about Harriet Tubman.
Easy now.
I'm gonna be free or die.
How important is it that these films kind of separate themselves from the competition? And is it often the case that people will latch on to a performance as opposed to a film?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. I think for the issues-based films, you have to look at a couple of factors. Number one, I think it's fatigue. It might be difficult to get them to spend on something that they might go see in the theater as escapism. I think the star-driven films will always sort of have a bigger advantage. You know, you mentioned Ford versus Ferrari, which is probably one of the few projects that Disney's excited about after they acquired Fox. But there are other things that can sort of creep into the consciousness. If you take a film like Parasite, which won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, it's a sort of a remarkable, incredibly strong comment on the class war that's going on, I think, all around the world.
So there are some films that are angling for awards, and there's some films mm-hmm. that are angling for anything they can get. I want to play a clip from one of the big fall titles, In Theory.
I've watched people I've loved die. Some fast with a bullet. Some not enough left to bury.
That's Sylvester Stallone sounding like he didn't either get enough sleep or caffeine. So we have Rambo Last Blood. We have Terminator Dark Fate. There's another Charlie's Angels movie. So the fall isn't all about awards movies. It's about big blockbusters. Is that also part of the fall season?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, there's a huge consumer angle, especially as we get closer to the holiday season. That's an important part of major studio business. And I think those three films you mentioned are actually really are pretty safe bets. I think that the Terminator Dark Fate reboot under Tim Miller is particularly strong because it pulls in a couple of timely themes like female empowerment. I do believe the movie is a bit of a meditation on immigration. But then you also have, you know, returning icons like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Linda Hamilton.
The other thing that certainly is going to happen in the fall is there are going to be a lot of big bets on movies that I think a lot of people are unsure about. I'm thinking off the top of my head about Tom Hooper, the director of the Oscar-winning The King's Speech. He has a movie version of Cats. How would you characterize the online reaction to its trailer?
I think maybe bewildered. I think that was a very polarizing but very sort of feverish response to the visual language of that film. But a studio executive recently reminded me of something that despite, you know, mockery or sort of blind curiosity about how they went about creating that world, Cats was the longest running musical of all time on Broadway.
And the other movies I would think are big rolls of the dice. Netflix has spent a lot of money on the Martin Scorsese movie The Irishman. Todd Phillips, who's probably best known for the Hangover films, has made a movie called Joker with Joaquin Phoenix playing the part made famous by Heath Ledger. And then Ang Lee, who's an incredible director, has made a movie with Will Smith called Gemini Man. When you are thinking about the riskiest bets of the fall, would some of those films be on your list?
Absolutely. And in terms of The Irishman, it is not just a considerable amount of money. It's the most Netflix has ever spent on an original feature production for several reasons. You have incredibly high wattage talent like Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, and of course, director Martin Scorsese. But because of the film's sort of unique use of computer graphics, all the actors at their current ages, which also includes Harvey Keitel, are sort of aged in reverse several decades, which is a very serious undertaking for the effects department, and it's incredibly expensive. And also Netflix is, I don't think it's any secret that they're desperate for a Best Picture winner, and this might be their best chance that they've ever had, barring last year's Roma from Alfonso Cuarón. For the Joker, I think that actually this one has a lot of heat around it as a possible serious awards contender. You know, there's something really different and sort of more insidiously creepy about Joaquin and what he brings to the character.
Is it just me? Or is it getting crazier out there?
What's also super interesting is that this doesn't really have a hero or doesn't have an antagonist. You know, there's no Batman in this Joker. It's an entire sort of meditation on what makes criminals and bad people bad.
I'm going to end with a challenge to you. We think of the summer season as where all of the highest grossing movies of the year come out, but there are three huge movies that are coming out toward the end of the year: Jumanji, The Next Level, Star Wars, Rise of Skywalker, and It, Chapter 2. Which one is going to be the biggest hit?
Oh, wow. I've seen about 20 minutes of It Chapter 2, and I think it's incredibly strong. And I think it will really, really have long, long legs and generate a ton of cash and make a star out of Bill Hader or a bigger star out of Bill Hader. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know that I can sit here and safely bet against Star Wars, John.
Okay, I can't bet against Jumanji, so we'll find out soon how that turns out. Matt Donnelly is a senior film writer at Variety. Matt, thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Coming up next on The Frame, the woman who plays Fleabag's sister, and later, the woman who is Fleabag's sister. Shawn Clifford is nominated for Best Supporting Actress in a Comedy Series for her role as Claire in Fleabag. It's one of 11 Emmy nominations for the series, which is produced by Amazon and the BBC. The character Fleabag, and yes, that's what she's called in the show, is played by series creator Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Clifford and Waller-Bridge are sisters in the world of the show, but it turns out they have a close real-life friendship that goes back to their days together in drama school. Clifford told me about how that connection informed their work on the set of Fleabag.
There is a collaboration that happens between us, but it's so intangible. I can't explain to you what it is. It's we definitely work together in quite a unique way on the set. The way that we communicate, I would say, without dialogue, actually. There's an understanding between us. But we suddenly looked at each other one day and we were like, you know, we never ever discussed how to play those characters. We just knew. And that trust that we have, because we have known each other for so long and been such close collaborators for so long, that's what it gifts us, and that's why one of the reasons why she fought for me to play that role.
I want to ask about that because
yeah,
I had some friends in college who were very good friends, and they wrote a musical and they wrote a part for me. And then when they got around to casting it, they didn't pick me. They picked somebody else.
No.
Which was its own kind of horror. But it also sounded like maybe that could have happened in this circumstance, that there was, who were the people who didn't want you to play the part if Phoebe did?
At the time, the theatre show that was the genesis of Fleabag, that existed, and our producer's two brothers were attached, and the BBC came on board after the sort of success of Fleabag, the theatre show. Yeah, they wanted a name for Claire.
They wanted Keira Knightley, I know it.
Yeah. I've never Phoebe's never said to me she's far too gracious a human to mention to me whoever whatever names they shoved under her nose, but she dismissed them all, and just she really picks her battles, Phoebe, and she is a true collaborator to the absolute last. But this was one that she would not back down on. And she just sort of said, the rapport that you will get between us that you get for free, you won't get with anyone else. And the chemistry. And it's been commented on a lot, which has been really special for us because we really feel it's there. So it's really nice when other people see it too.
I want to play a clip from a scene from this current season and about you and your sister, Claire and Fleabag, and about their kind of conflicted, messy, but in the end, I think very, very beautiful relationship.
Take this. I'll try to talk Martin down, but call him if you need him. He's a very good lawyer. Surprisingly tender underneath it all.
Knew it.
What you did in the restaurant was unforgivable.
I know.
Thank you.
I think that almost defines their relationship. What you did was unforgivable. Thank you. And yeah. They obviously, there are days where they don't get along very well, but ultimately, even if their tactics are slightly flawed, they really care and are trying to protect each other.
I love this relationship. It feels so truthful to me. It reflects my own experience of having a sister and the sort of the nuance of that is captured so beautifully in this series. I've never seen it portrayed like this on a television screen before or in a film or anywhere. I've never seen it so accurately depicted. What I'm starting to realise is that all the characters sort of mention things that they might be talking about themselves, but they can relate to any number of the characters in the show. And it's actually what our dad says, played by the glorious Bill Paterson. He says, you know, that he loves Fleabag, but he doesn't know if he likes her all the time. And I think that's the same for Fleabag and Claire. Like, the love is unquestionable. It's unconditional. But they do not. They're not friends. They're sisters.
Right. Well, and, but sometimes that bond is stronger than even friendship.
Yeah, I think it absolutely is. And there's a scene in episode one of season two where, despite their differences, Fleabag kind of drops everything to step up for her sister. And I have experienced that so many times in my own life, not just with my own sister, but with my female friends. It's so, you know, it's just a given. Like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what's going on. There'll always be this nurturing aspect of women and sisterhood that's just like, it's just there no matter what.
We're talking with Sean Clifford, who plays Claire in Fleabag. I want to play another clip from the current season where your character develops a crush on one of her co-workers from Finland.
I'm going to get a drink. Do you want anything?
Oh, champagne, please.
Oh, off the wagon?
Not just when I'm with you. Let's go crazy tonight then.
Hmm? What did you say?
No, I was...
No, what did you say?
I just said, let's go like crazy tonight. Oh, God.
Okay.
I think so much of what's going on is about that idea of voicing things you're feeling or not saying the things that you're feeling, about the restraint, the internal dialogue, and that everything that these characters are saying, even if they're, you know, off camera or breaking the fourth wall, is about what they're really feeling.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that's so typically British, I've got to say. Like, it's just... that's why everyone is so tense. And actually, a lot of people talk to me about the rigidity of Claire's body, but I'm not conscious of it, genuinely. It's not something I'm choosing to do. It just happens to my body when I'm in the rhythm of Claire. And it is. It's just like, you can't talk about anything. Or when Fleabag says to her therapist, you know, she says, do you talk? And she's talking about her family. And Fleabag says, God, no. And yeah, it's just yeah, deeply repressed culturally, the British.
I want to ask you about what it's like on set. And I'm going to play a clip from the first season where Fleabag is breaking the fourth wall while everybody else is not. So let's listen to this from the first season.
The only thing harder than having to tell your super high-powered, perfect, anorexic, rich super sister that you've run out of money is having to ask her to bail you out. I'm just going to ask her. I'm just going to come.
Do you need to borrow money?
No. Can't do it.
This happens throughout the series, but I'm wondering, as an actor, I mean, you almost have to tune out those things that are being said off camera, because even though Phoebe's saying them, you're not hearing them. What is that like when you're actually shooting those scenes?
It was really hard initially, actually, really challenging. We would have conversations as a cast, like how to handle those moments. But for me, you just have to stay in the scene. And there are actually moments where I look at her and she's talking to the camera. So I'm looking directly at her, but I don't see the, you know, the look away. But you just get used to it.
So much of the show is about people either not appreciating a moment or appreciating the moment way too much and making a terrible mistake because of that moment. And I was struck by the fact that you have started a meditation website. And I'm wondering if you think about your interests about mental health and relaxation and contemplation, and whether or not somebody like Claire would benefit from taking your own training.
Well, it's not actually teaching meditation. Like, meditation is an aspect of it, and I'm very interested in conscious awareness practices. So, sort of deepening your connection to yourself
being
in
present.
More meaningful ways. Yes, exactly. I think people are quite struck when they meet me in real life how different I am from Claire, which is a real compliment to me. I think, but the in terms of, you know, I love it when people are like, oh my God, you're so different. And I'm like, yeah, I actually love Claire. I do think she's got a long way to go in terms of her own healing journey. But I do think by the end of season two that she is on a different track, a very different track.
And are we not going to see where that track goes? Because I keep thinking about the not very good James Bond movie, Never Say Never Again. Great title. Is that true that we're not going to see how this all works out? Is it 11 Emmy nominations? End of season two, goodbye, Fleabag?
Initially, when we wrapped, I was like, don't worry, guys, to our producers. I was like, I'm going to keep chipping away at this. I'm going to try and get a season three. And actually, we ended up doing a reshoot day. And that was about 6 weeks after we'd wrapped. And it's very rare that those things happen in a UK production. And we had this extraordinary day, shooting new material, actually. And it was one of the happiest days I know of mine and Phoebe's, like, creative life on the show. Wow. We had just the best time. And we spoke on the phone that evening, and I was like, does this make you want to do it again? Because it was just, and she was like, it is just the most fun. So I thought then, I was like, this is it. Guys, I've clinched the deal. And then, funnily enough, I was sat in on a lot of the edit of this second season, and I would often come in on the final pass of episodes and be a bit of a litmus test for the team. Being a part of that process and going through it and getting to the end of it, it was during that process that I sort of made peace and was like, no, I think we're done.
Wow, you will be missed.
Oh.
Sean Clifford plays Claire on Fleabag. Sean, thanks so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
Coming up, Isabel Waller-Bridge writes the music for Fleabag, and yes, it's a family affair. Following my conversation with Sean Clifford, the actress who plays the sibling Claire in Fleabag, it seems only natural that we meet the real-life older sister of show creator and star Phoebe Waller-Bridge. After all, she's the show's composer. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving tracked her down in London.
Isabel Waller-Bridge doesn't score Fleabag like a traditional show. The first season, which came out on Amazon Prime in 2016, mostly just featured a heavy metal piece that plays under the end credits.
As soon as I found that, we knew immediately, and I sent it through to, you know, producers and the director, and Phoebe just sent me a video of them when they were first listening to it, and they were all headbanging to it, and it was just like, that really felt really spirit of Fleabag.
Fleabag is about a single woman in London who crashes through the world, sleeping around, stealing, and generally making poor choices, but all to hilarious effect.
You know, she's a very unexpected character, and she's got a huge spirit, and she's really, really punchy. And, you know, she's making all these mistakes, and she's living this sort of chaotic life, and she's chasing peace in a way, and like running from grief, and really trying to kind of like figure her life out. But we didn't want it to be sentimentalized at all.
Isabel Waller-Bridge sounds exactly like her sister over the phone. I called her at home in East London, just across town from where she grew up with her sister Phoebe, who's 15 months younger, and who she genuinely calls Flea.
Yes, I do. My whole family does. We all have nicknames, and hers from the word go has been Flea, really from when she was a baby. And my family call me, occasionally, they call me Mouse. And my brother was a worm. He was Worm at one point, but that sort of unsurprisingly got dropped quite quickly.
Mouse started playing the piano at age 4. She was composing from an early age, and she wrote her first short film score as a teenager. She was pretty much always collaborating with Phoebe.
Because she was writing lots of poems and lyrics, and I was sort of writing music, and we just thought we'd kind of combine them. We were making radio plays, and we did it with a couple of friends, some neighbours of ours. We were probably about sort of 13 or 14 at the time, I think. We'd all huddle in a cupboard and record the play and do all the Foley sounds, and I'd make a bit of music.
I asked her if Phoebe's naughty sense of humour was in evidence back then.
Yes, it was all absolutely there. It really has always been there.
The priest is quite hot.
So hot.
In the second season, Fleabag falls in love with a priest. A hot priest, played by Andrew Scott. We gradually learn that she's also processing the grief of losing her mother, and she's encouraging her sister to leave a toxic marriage. It called for more music and a very different flavor.
The themes that were being explored were really mature and sort of Greek, you know. It was like big, you know, like family and redemption and religion and forgiveness. And so then it felt like maybe a Greek chorus kind of a soundtrack might be interesting. And then because it's much about religion, I was, you know, suggesting that we should maybe actually make it, you know, a Kyrie eleison. And I only really wanted to use the first few words of that, but in the Greek. And that sort of became the main theme.
Of course, this being Fleabag, it's not a straightforward religious message.
There are some words that are not in the traditional text. Yeah, Phoebe and I, one night late, we suddenly thought, what would happen if we sort of did some wordplay? And so there are a few anatomical words. Anatomical feels like the right word, I think. And also there's a bit of Latin that I'm using, which is nos venit, and that's we're coming. And so I use we're coming, he's coming, she's coming. And I really mean it as that, you know, redemption is coming or freedom is coming, or and the things are on the horizon and they're all coming so that, you know, closer together, like the family. But of course there's also the other meaning of it.
The feelings in the season 2 score are big, even melodramatic, like the scene where Fleabag refuses to talk to the priest about her pain, and she walks through the city to some matador-like spaghetti western music. But the music is never earnest. One of the charms of the show is how it deals with heavy topics like grief, miscarriage, and heartbreak, but always with an arch wink. That's Phoebe Waller-Bridge's sensibility, and it's shared by her sister.
When you see someone crying but they're smiling, those kinds of contrasts are really, really powerful, I think. And I think with music, you've got to be slightly self-aware, I think, with it. And, you know, you can play the epicness of the feeling, but as soon as you start taking it too, if you're too earnest with it, it just dissolves. And it's alienating, weirdly. The vulnerability is there, but because the sense of humour is there, it becomes a choice for the audience to step towards it if they want to.
And with 11 Emmy nominations, clearly plenty of people do. For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
That's it for today. I'm John Horn. We're back here tomorrow at the Moan Broadcast Center.